I had, up until today, visited 49 states. So this is officially my 50th state.
President Obama speaks at Elmendorf Air Force Base from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 12th of November. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaska journalists take on Hollywood and win.
They made up some cockamamie story about whatever, about somebody that didn't exist.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world.
President Barack Obama greeted troops and their families at Elmendorf Air Force Base today during a brief stop on his way to his first presidential visit to Asia. Obama spoke for just under 15 minutes. APRN's Lori Townsend was there.
The president thanked General Troy, state and local leaders, and asked Senator Mark Begich to stand up. He said it was wonderful to be at Elmendorf, calling it one of America's finest bases. The president said he was bringing a simple message of thanks to the soldiers and families for their sacrifice. He said, "These have been days of tribute," mentioning the Fort Hood Memorial he attended 2 days ago and the Veterans Day ceremony at Arlington yesterday. He said serving as commander-in-chief is the greatest privilege he has as president.
By being here, all of you are joining a long line of service at Elmendorf, from the liberation of Pacific Islands during World War II through a long Cold War. You embody that creed, faithful to a proud heritage, a tradition of honor, and a legacy of valor. You uphold that legacy every day.
President Obama listed off many of the units from the 90th Fighter Squadron to the 4th Brigade Combat Team. He acknowledged those Alaska-based soldiers who had been killed in the Middle East recently, Timothy Bowles and Julian Brelsford.
And citizens of this state, like Alaska native Corporal Gregory Fleury, raised in Anchorage, he joined the Marines and served two tours in Iraq. He loved the Corps, he loved Alaska, so much so that he carried the state flag with him everywhere. It was with him last month when he was killed in those helicopter crashes in Afghanistan. A little while ago, I had the honor of meeting Greg's family, Donna and Christopher, and his grandfather, Albert. And I expressed the gratitude of our nation, and we thank them for being with us here today. Donna, Albert, please stand.
The president said that as the soldiers had fulfilled their responsibilities to their nation, the nation must also fulfill its responsibilities to them. He said that's why he's increasing the defense budget, halted reductions in the Air Force, and increased the size of the Army ahead of schedule. He said he would not put soldiers in harm's way unless it was necessary, but if he did, he said America would have their back.
We'll give you the strategy and the clear mission you deserve. We'll give you the equipment and support that you need to get the job done, and that includes public support back home. That is a promise that I make to you.
And he said as troops meet their missions around the world, America would take care of their families.
That's why the First Lady, Michelle, has been visiting bases across the country. Go, Michelle. Your family is a priority for our family. So we're increasing pay, we're increasing child care, we're increasing support to help spouses and families deal with the stress and separation of war. And finally, we pledge to be there when you come home. We're improving care for our wounded warriors, especially those with PTSD and traumatic brain injuries.
President Obama closed by saying his administration would fund the post-9/11 GI Bill. He said he was supporting the largest VA budget increase in 30 years. After his formal remarks, President Obama left the stage and walked through the crowd, shaking hands and talking with soldiers and family members. Sergeant First Class Arthur Crump said he'd been in Alaska for 5 years, and although he's been in the service much longer than that, this was the first time he'd seen a U.S. president. He said he was glad the president named the units.
It just shows us that our leadership, you know, is aware of what we're doing and you know, that they're not, you know, out of touch, you know, that they're in touch with what we're doing, and soldiers, as well as, you know, my fellow brethren, appreciate that, so.
Soldier Bobby Baca returned just last month from a 15-month deployment with the 62nd Transportation Company in Iraq. He and his wife and two small children were all smiles as he said he was glad to be able to be there.
And I was happy to bring my family, and I love the speech about the support for the families. It's much needed and really appreciate it.
After several minutes of shaking hands, President Obama left Elmendorf and boarded Air Force One and headed for Asia. In Anchorage, I'm Lori Townsend.
Noticeably absent from the president's address today were any of the top Republican office holders from Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski is on a rural trip to Kotzebue and Nome, where she's visiting schools, touring hospital projects, and meeting with community members. She issued a statement today welcoming President Obama, saying she is sorry she couldn't attend. Alaska's other Republican in Congress, Don Young, also opted to stay home. He's in Washington, D.C., even though the Capitol is quiet with the Veterans Day recess this week. Alaska Governor Sean Parnell was in Anchorage today, but he said he had plans to give a speech at a general contractors conference. Parnell is hoping to meet with the president on his way back through Alaska after his trip to Asia. Governor Parnell says Alaska needs to spend more time and money taking care of the state's buildings and infrastructure, recognizing that maintenance repairs are usually low profile and not very politically popular items in the state budget. Parnell says he plans to elevate the subject this year and in the future with a separate highlighted part of the budget, spending $100 million to fix things.
To me, taking care of Alaska's deferred maintenance, fixing what we've got, it just makes sense. As stewards of our finite dollars, it doesn't make sense for the state to let its assets deteriorate further. An emphasis on deferred maintenance will mean Alaska's construction industry will have jobs, jobs they can depend on each and every year for the next 5 years. The common sense approach that this offers is new to state government, but it's necessary.
Parnell pointed out that, counting the university, the state owns 2,300 buildings that need repair, and the cost of those repairs adds up to $1.8 billion. He says the executive branch departments have already begun making lists of needed work. The budget he presents to the legislature in December will include the highest priority projects, and the university is getting $37 million of those dollars. University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor Fran Ulmer says deferred maintenance items are always a part of the university's budget, but the subject needs the governor's focus. She says that would give agencies such as her own the ability to plan more efficiently.
It's appropriate for the governor to take the lead on deferred maintenance because, as the steward of our state's assets, this is an important way of making sure that for a long time into the future, we have these facilities, these roads, these ferries, these airports in the kind of condition that we need them in.
Parnell said there is time to work out details on the budget, such as a percentage stream that each department will be allowed to spend. He says he does not anticipate the need for any central authority to reauthorize the priority lists that executive branch departments will make. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, puzzling over the origins of the Haida language.
The one area that really sticks out as being the most distinct aspect of culture is the language.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com.
None of Southeast Alaska's three native languages are related to each other. Jordan Lachler, a linguist with the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, says there may be some bonds between the Tsimshian, Tlingit, and Haida people, but language isn't one of them.
In terms of culture, there's a lot that's very, very similar. There are definitely differences, but there are many, many similarities. But the one area that really sticks out as being the most distinct aspect of culture among all three groups is the language.
Lachler says there are two theories about the origins of Tsimshian. The most popular is that it's a branch of Penutian, a group of native languages with speakers in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Northern California. But another is that it's related to a variety of Indo-European languages. The theory was first put forth by John Asher Dunn, whose Tsimshian dictionary and grammar books have been published by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Tlingit is part of a language family known as AET, which stands for Athabaskan Eyak Tlingit. Lachler says linguists had long thought that Tlingit and Athabaskan were somehow related, but it wasn't until researchers tied Athabaskan and Eyak together within the last 30 years that a definitive connection between Athabaskan and Tlingit was made. Research done in the last 2 years has shown that AET languages are related to a Central Siberian language called Ket, which was long thought to have no relationship to other languages. Lachler says Haida is the most puzzling case of the three Southeast native languages. For most of the 20th century, linguists thought Haida had to fit in with the AET, but the discovery that Ket is related to AET has convinced most researchers that Haida is not, in fact, related to any of those languages.
So if that's the case, if Haida does not belong with Athabaskan, Eyak, Tlingit, and Ket, then what we have is a language isolate, right? So it means we have no known relatives for Haida.
Lachler says out of about 6,000 known languages, there are only 40 or so isolates. He's editing a Haida dictionary and phrasebook that will be published by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. He made his comments as part of a lecture series being sponsored by the Institute for Native American Awareness Month. Residents of the village of McCoryuk are furiously trying to learn all they can from their two remaining elders. The village, located on Nunavak Island in the Bering Sea, is home to the only living Chupinch civilization in the world. And their elders are the only remaining Chupinch people to live before Western civilization was established on the island. From Ever Station KYUK in Bethel, John Active reports.
Howard Amos is the executive director of the Nuniwarmiut Pichiriaraita Tamariaiskuti. He is spearheading the cultural program designed to preserve and revitalize the Chupig language and culture for the children of Nunivak Island. Currently, the participants of this innovative program are translating and transcribing audio tapes that were recorded as early as 1970 through the 1990s. They are also continuing to record interviews with remaining elders in McCoyuk. Amos says the elders are living treasures.
We really cherish their wisdom from our past days.
In the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, there are three dialects spoken by three groups of Alaska natives, one being Yupik of the Yukon-Kuskokwim deltas, the other Chupik of Chivak, and then the Chupich of Nunivak Island. The village school has been enthusiastic about the new Chupich curriculum. However, a local church opposed teaching the school children traditional dance.
It's still a controversial situation for us. You know, we're clashing between the Evangelical Covenant Church and a community. They think that we're practicing shamanism, stuff like that, which is not the case. We don't do that, and we use these dancing exercises for entertainment purposes and just to have a lot of fun.
16-year-old Aaron Keokan says listening to the audio tapes and watching the videos has taught her about Chupig life in the early days.
The way they treated people, how to act, cooking, how to prepare food, how to treat your husband, actually how to treat everybody with respect.
Howard Amos says the interviews are an important teaching tool.
We're very fortunate that we were able to do some interviews dating back to 1970s, so we have lots of information.
19-year-old Aaron Oscar agrees. He learned something new about his great-grandmother from the current curriculum being taught.
I learned that my great-grandma was more than 60 miles in one day. They used to live in houses or sod houses all over the island that I didn't know about.
Aaron says the Chupik curriculum is making history less of a subject for study and turning it into a personal search to learn about his ancestors.
They learn by talking to their parents and their grandparents and all the other elders, stuff I wish I could do. I would have liked to go kayaking with them, to go hunting. I would like to take a dog team and go across the island with them.
Many in Makoyak are concerned that with the passing of this generation of Chupig elders, so goes their knowledge and wisdom that could lead to the downfall of the Chupig culture and language. But Howard Amos says that as long as the youth are interested, the Chupig culture will continue to exist.
It's important that this continues on for years to come, because if we lose it, it's going to be gone forever.
In Bethel, I'm John Active.
Can you state your name for the camera?
Dr. Abigail Tyler.
The sci-fi film The Fourth Kind is set in Nome, but some residents of Alaska's Gold Rush City disputed the film's premise of extraterrestrial abductions in Nome a decade ago. Members of the Alaska Press Club in particular were disturbed by Universal Studios' use of fake news archives on websites used to promote the movie. Anchorage attorney John McKay took the matter seriously, and today Alaska journalists won a victory when Universal Studios agreed to pay the Alaska Press Club $20,000 in damages.
I just want to salute John for thinking about this. He considered this an injury to journalism in the state of Alaska in a significant way, and he looked around for some way to remedy that or to correct it, and he frankly thought it might be a few hundred dollars or maybe $1,000, and it turned out to be a larger amount than that, which at this point sort of doubles our budget.
That's Kathleen McCoy, president of the Alaska Press Club. McKay could not be reached for comment, but Nancy McGuire, editor of the Nome Nugget, says the promotional campaign caused nothing but confusion.
They made up some cockamamie story about whatever, about somebody that didn't exist, and they put my name on it, and it was published in the Nome Nugget. And a lot of people are calling us and asking, is it true? Did people really get abducted by aliens? And, they're frightened about it, and they're ignorant and uninformed. They really do believe that we do have alien abductions here.
McGuire calls the settlement a mutually satisfactory resolution. Universal Studios has also made a donation to Nome's Nest program for the homeless. Five other Alaska media outlets, including the Fairbanks News Miner, joined in filing the complaint.
Abduction.
Someone or something came into my room. And it took me away.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision. People with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org.
This message sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
At a special presentation commemorating Veterans Day at the Sitka Chamber of Commerce yesterday, members were asked if they knew the difference between Veterans Day and Memorial Day. Veterans Day was originally known as Armistice Day to commemorate the end of World War I, the, quote, war to end all wars. Veterans Day may seem like a strange midweek holiday to many people, but to others it has a powerful meaning. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Several decades and wars after the establishment of Armistice Day, Korean War vets successfully lobbied to rename the 11th day of the 11th month Veterans Day. And, as one chamber member put it, veterans are walking around while Memorial Day honors your mates who never came back. That observation could never be more true than for Roy Bailey, a guest of the chamber. Bailey was a private in the 71st Infantry Division, which engaged in one of the bloodiest and most pivotal battles in the European theater of World War II, the Battle of the Bulge. Bailey had lost his voice and did not speak on Wednesday, but he has told his story to the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. 19,000 Allied soldiers died between December of 1944 and January of 1945 in northern Belgium. Bailey told the Veterans History Project that a part of being a veteran is remembering comrades who did not survive.
A bit about being exceptionally happy that you are alive only lasts temporary, because all your buddies that you knew, a lot of them are still over there in graveyards, and the horrible feeling of guilt is indescribable. That I'm here alive, why should I be when they are over there? The guys I trained with, guys I went into combat with.
Bailey was wounded in the engagement and subsequently listed as missing in action. His disappearance and injuries were later questioned by military authorities, due in part to discriminatory practices that were prevalent at the time. Bailey told the Veterans History Project that he discovered some ethnic confusion while awaiting treatment on a stretcher in a field hospital.
The doctors and nurses and, of course, the orderlies were busy and the place never stopped. Somehow or other, the word got out that there was an Eskimo in the bunch and everyone was stopping to see who the Eskimo was or where he was. So I got up on my elbow to see where this Eskimo was. I asked him where the Eskimo was, and the orderly said, "That's you, you dummy."
Bailey is a Tlingit Indian born in Petersburg. Sitka Historical Society Director Bob Mettinger told the chamber that discrimination in the military, particularly against Native servicemen like Roy Bailey, and even in Sitka during wartime, was a difficult subject to approach for his organization.
A lot of history is not pleasant, and Sitka has had its share. When I got here, I personally noticed, I'm not meaning to offend anybody, but I'm just going to tell you, people didn't want to talk about a lot of stuff that went on here. And even the historians, the professionals, I said, well, what about this? We don't talk about that. What do you mean you don't talk about it? This is history. No, we don't talk about it here. And I'm kind of shaking my head, and I realize, every town's different, but, history is history.
Mettinger said that the Historical Museum had plans to reexamine the role of Sitka in wartime, the good and the bad, and the involvement of the people who built the Naval Air Station and Sitka's harbor defenses, and the stories of combat veterans like Roy Bailey. In 1998, 50 years after surviving the Battle of the Bulge, Roy Bailey was awarded the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A resolution aimed at protecting Alaska's natural environment was recently passed by a unanimous vote at the Orthodox Diocese of Alaska Annual Assembly. From member station KDLG, Adam Kane has the story.
According to the Acting Chancellor of the Orthodox Diocese of Alaska, Archpriest Michael James Alexa, one of the resolutions that passed recently at the Annual Assembly asked for state and federal officials to approve resource developments only after there is a guarantee that the development will protect the purity and viability of Alaska's natural lands and waters.
The resolution cites the fact that Native Alaskans have always treated their land with respect and considered it a sacred trust to keep the land and the water and the animals in their pristine and natural condition as a sacred relationship to their environment.
Father Michael says that the resolution is not against development altogether. However, he says that before a project can gain the church's approval, there must be physical proof that the project is safe for the environment.
The resolution also says that we would invoke God's blessing upon any development that could be proven, not with us as the guinea pig, so to speak, but if a mine, for example, or any kind of development was going to be undertaken in our region, we would support it, provided they could prove to us that elsewhere, at some other place, they had successfully engaged in this sort of development without destroying the environment. If they've done it someplace else, then we'll trust them that they can do it here.
Father Michael says that the church used scripture from the Bible when crafting the resolution to make sure that their message conveyed their moral, ethical, as well as spiritual vision.
This gives the church a sort of biblical and theological basis for saying we are responsible for the sanctity of the whole creation, and that this position we're taking against any development that threatens that is part of our moral and our ethical as well as our spiritual vision of life.
Father Michael says that though this was the first time the Orthodox Diocese of Alaska has weighed in on an environmental issue, globally, the church is well known for its efforts in protecting the environment.
On a global level, not at all. The Ecumenical Patriarch is now known, the Archbishop of Constantinople, is called the Green Patriarch in Europe for all his pronouncements on environmental issues. But this is the first time our diocese here in Alaska has taken such a stand publicly.
The resolution was addressed to state and federal officials who are ultimately responsible for permitting developments in the state of Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, John Active in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Adam Kane in Dillingham. APRN's Lori Townsend reported from Anchorage and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the new AT&T, your world delivered,
and by
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision, and people with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired, with support from Lions Clubs.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.